We're on the air. Let's see how the broadcast gets from the studio to your home.
I just want to hear the music, that's all.
Is it too complicated to just keep my records in the category, okay? Just put the rock and roll in with the rock and roll. Put the R&B in with the R&B. I mean, you're not going to put Charlie Parker in with the rock and roll, would you?
What does it all mean?
I don't know. Who is Charlie Parker?
Yes!
Sounds Visual is a podcast featuring interviews and long-form conversations with DJs, crate diggers, record collectors, vinyl enthusiasts, beat makers, producers, and musicians. Okay, welcome to another episode of Sounds Visual Radio. My name is Justin. Thanks for tuning in. My guest today on the podcast is John McCrae. John is a founding member of the band Cake. John grew up in an area exposed to wide-ranging musical influences, including country music, mariachi, rock, funk, Iranian folk music, and hip-hop, just to name a few. Cake formed in the early 90s in Northern California as a somewhat antagonistic answer to grunge. Following the self-release of its debut album, Motorcade of Generosity, the band was signed to Capricorn Records in 1995 and released its first single, Rock and Roll Lifestyle, which hit number 35 on the Modern Rock Tracks chart and was featured on MTV's 120 Minutes. Cake's second album, 1996's Fashion Nugget, went platinum on the strength of its lead single, The Distance. Prolonging the Magic, the band's third album, was released in 1998 and also went platinum, having shipped over 1 million units. In 2011, the band created its own label, Upbeat Records, and released their album, Showroom of Compassion, which became their first record to debut at the top of the Billboard charts. Cake has also hinted at their upcoming seventh studio album, with the release date to be determined. If you want to see Cake live, you can check out their tour dates at cakemusic.com. If you want to drop us a line here at the podcast, our email is soundsvisualradio@gmail.com. If you'd like to hear other episodes of the show, you can find them archived anytime at mixcloud.com/soundsvisualradio. Okay, let's talk to John McCrae from Cake.
You know, I grew up listening to, you know, my parents' music, which was like on my mom's side of the collection was a lot of folk music, Woody Guthrie, Bob Dylan, all that kind of stuff. And my dad listened to a bunch of Russian gypsy accordion music, and he played the accordion. And my mother also played folk songs on the acoustic guitar. So alternately, some nights I would have a hard time falling asleep because I was irritated by the accordion. And then other nights I would have a hard time falling asleep because I was sad from the minor key lilting folk song melodies. So yeah, but I think that probably impacted, you know, the geometry, I guess, of my melodic sensibility. I do think it matters what you hear when you're young. As I got older, I started listening to whatever the hell was on the AM radio, and I, you know, 70s R&B, and you know, I have a really, really lucid memory of hearing Stevie Wonder's Superstition for the first time on an AM radio and being just sort of awestruck by everything about it. And, you know, I don't have very many memories of childhood, but I remember hearing that song and saying to myself, holy fuck. And then as I got older, I got more into, you know, I guess some rock, some Beatles, what kids listen to. And then, you know, later, like classic rock and disco. I really liked disco for some reason. I think the bass lines made sense to me. I've always, from a very young age, I think realized in a way that maybe not everyone is able to realize that bass is sometimes the reason why you like a song. People tend to think it's always the guitar or some sort of more front-facing instrument, but a lot of times it's actually the interaction between the bass and whatever that instrument that you thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real reason you listen to it. So anyway, I had this weird sort of, I didn't see any cognitive dissonance between disco and Led Zeppelin or AC/DC or, you know, 70s classic rock. And then, as a teenager, I moved to Scotland for a while and got sort of exposed to the punk movement, which was just sort of dying and sort of undermining itself slowly.
How did you end up in Scotland?
My dad had to move there for work.
Okay.
And
what did he do?
He was a teacher who was going to go study with my dad's a mathematician.
Okay.
So he was going to study with a mathematician who was about to die and had some theories or something. And so he brought the family. And so that was sort of mind-blowing, you know, just to have, you know, generally, like, I think to be an American kid in a different country is really about, was good for me to realize that other people are doing things differently and it's working out just fine. That in and of itself was really, I think, a good thing. But also musically, you know, there was just a lot of differences musically between the United States and the UK. And so anyway, I you know, heard The Clash and Squeeze and, you know, a lot of ska and stuff like that. You know, probably as it was starting to wane there, came back to the United States and it was just starting to bubble up.
So you got it all over again.
Got it kind of all over again, and I wasn't as interested the second time.
Yeah.
It was more Southern Californian, almost like there was a difference socioeconomically between the people who were punk in England and Scotland and the people who adopted it here. Here it was like often an expression of privilege, that you would be able to not have a job and have a mohawk, that you would be able to like pierce all of your, you know, your eyelids and ears and everything. That was a sign of wealth in a way here. Whereas there, it was, you know, it was a lot more BO and spit and urine involved in punk rock.
More confrontational.
Yeah, more confrontational and more bodily fluids,
yeah,
and smells. Here is really clean. It was like, I think I flew back into LA, LAX, and I remember seeing a punk at the airport, and it was the cleanest punk I'd ever seen. It was like so spiffy.
It was an LA punk.
It was a gleaming punk rock rebellion. And so I think at a very early age, I took a very skeptical stand on, you know, youth rebellion and like the sort of the essence of youth rebellion. And I think at a very young age, I just thought it's mostly hormones and consumerism. So yeah, so that was maybe good for me, but also bad for me. But I think, you know, I definitely think my early songwriting reflected that. I started playing guitar and bass and writing songs right around that same time. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that I was just from the outset, probably too skeptical of youth cultural rebellion. And then gradually, as I started getting into my late teens and early 20s, I started realizing that country was a good thing. At first, I got into it like slightly ironically, and then it grabbed me, and I became, you know, it's like I wasn't, there was absolutely no irony in it at all anymore. And I think I used country to get through a breakup with beer involved, and suddenly country really made a lot of sense.
What was the song or the artist that
changed it? It was George Jones. Yeah, George Jones. I mean, and beer got me through a really horrible breakup.
Okay.
She told him you'll forget in time. As the years went slowly by, she still preyed upon his mind. He kept her picture on his wall.
And from then on, I really took country seriously. And listening to a lot of Hank Williams Sr. at that same point, you know, made me realize that, you know, it doesn't take very many chords to make great art, and also great sort of emotionally compelling narrative. You know, it really, Hank Williams really blew my mind at a certain point. As did the vocal stylings of George Jones, and then I stumbled on some other things like Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys and the Leuven Brothers, and just mostly older country. You know, there's really good songwriting from every decade, though. The production values of country certainly have been sketchy from time to time, but the songwriting is always pretty strong. And then, yeah, so in my 20s, I really started writing a lot of songs. And I think actually listening to Hank Williams Sr. for a long time made it seem possible, because there's just like, it wasn't clouded with arrangement. He just plays the guitar a lot of times and sings, and that's it. And you can really, it's really sort of a transparent view of a song. And yeah, so.
It's kind of like Dylan, right? You just put the mic up and let him do his thing on those early records, you know?
Right.
Three chords and the truth.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, and the truth housed within a mathematically pleasing combination of notes, you know? That's something that I think Bob Dylan gets not enough credit for, is how catchy his melodies were. I think Dylan, I don't know if you read like any of his prose, but like Tarantula or something, but for me, a lot less compelling than when his words are sort of, his words, when they're corralled by a certain kind of meter that is can't change, a lot more fun to read or listen to.
So what I'm hearing from you then is you sort of had this plurality going on. You had the folk music, you had the Russian music you're hearing from your dad, you're hearing classic AM radio stuff, you know, Bay Area stuff, funk, soul, but you're also hearing punk music that you hear from Scotland, you're getting into country music. So all of this is kind of bubbling up inside, you know, your mind in terms of when you first pick up the guitar and your bass and you're starting to write songs, I mean, you weren't just listening to one thing.
No, I'm not rejecting any of it musically.
Yeah.
Like, culturally, I think I rejected punk rock a bit because of some hypocrisy that I saw. And I saw the bloat of classic rock and, you know, big dumb American wide load music.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not have any problem with it musically.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I never thought Bad Company sucked. Like, musically, I kind of still like some of their songs. Like, but every friend I ever grew up with had to reject them at a certain point because of...
of what it represented.
Because of, like, punk rock and indie culture or whatever.
Yeah.
The marijuana leaf belt buckle thing or whatever. But I am sort of proud that I didn't feel so obligated to reject something on a cultural basis.
Mm-hmm.
That I think had musical value.
Yeah.
And still has that. So, yeah.
Did you go to college?
I was in and out of college.
Okay.
I had a financial aid that was cut in half by a Republican and... so I was kind of disgruntled and not in college in the way that I wanted to be, which was good that I was angry, and I think I wrote more songs as a result.
You had a chip on your shoulder.
Yeah. but then I also went to university, like, I'd go for a year and then drop out and go for a year and drop out, which was perfect. Like, I wasn't going there to graduate. I was taking classes that I was interested in, you know, a lot of English classes and just what a history mm-hmm. and anthropology.
And so had you started a band yet by this point?
I wanted to. I was playing with, like, some musicians here and there.
Okay.
But nothing really stuck that well. God, I don't know. You know, I think I would start bands for short periods of time and it just didn't quite, there was something wrong and it stopped and
mm-hmm.
for various kinds of things. And then... I got signed to a management deal. I took everything, all the money I had, and realized that my music probably wasn't appropriate for what was going on in the States. And because everything was really big sounding here, and I just sort of gave up and said, okay, I'm going to take my demo tape that I've made with my band and bring it to some people in England. And there's also a label in Paris, and, like, where music was smaller sounding. And so I did get signed there and then dropped a year later, and super frustrating, super disheartening. But I just kind of kept on going and decided, well, maybe I'll be a songwriter. So I moved to LA for about a couple years, tried to do that, came close to a songwriting deal. Thank God it didn't work out, because it would have been really, really exploitative, like, toward me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would have had to, like, really sort of sell my soul. And I think, thankfully, I was... not so desperate and also careful enough to not get into that deal. But it would have like given other people too much power over what I did. Anyway, so that failed, moved back to Sacramento, where I was from, where I'd gone to high school, and formed a band again with a lot of songs under my belt and a lot of, like, failure and a lot of, you know, just sort of learning what worked and what didn't work, and first before I got the band going, I played solo, at, like, some bars and cafes, and I had, like, a night where I would play maybe 2 or 3 hours of music.
Of all your music or covers?
All my music, and then maybe some covers thrown in.
Oh, wow.
So I had a lot of songs and a lot of covers that I knew, really good for songwriting, to play other people's songs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it actually gets you, like, into their heads.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and then people started saying, well, you should start get a band going, and So I, you know, there were some people in town that I thought were good, and I asked if they wanted to play, and things started coming together and falling apart and coming together again and falling apart. And eventually we ended up with a lineup that, you know, we were able to play shows, and we started getting more and more people to the shows. And
and was it Cake already by this point?
Had you already? Yeah, it was okay. Cake. At that point, it was Cake. And, you know, I think we made a little EP, like 4-song EP, and, you know, sold it at shows with T-shirts and stuff, and kind of made a living playing up and down the West Coast. Eventually, it took, like, you know, a year or so to build a following that where we could play Seattle and have people show up or whatever. And then we released our first album, which was Motorcade of Generosity. And that was with our own money that we recorded it and pressed it up and released it, and actually ended up doing pretty okay in Europe. And Rock and Roll Lifestyle was a song that got played. I think it was on the charts on college radio here. But other than that, nobody really knew about us in the States.
Well, your CD collection looks shiny and costly. How much did you pay for your bad Moto Guzzi? And how much did you spend on your black leather jacket? Is it you or your parents in this income tax bracket? Now tickets to concerts and drinking at clubs, sometimes for music that you haven't even heard of. And how much did you pay for your rock and roll t-shirt that proves you were there, that you heard of them first? Now, how do you afford your rock and roll lifestyle? How do you afford your...
You guys self-released that, or that was through...
Yeah, that was self-released. We got distribution through Tower Records, and that's how we got to Europe.
Okay.
Tower Records was still... still existed.
Good old Tower Records.
Yeah, and it was great because, like, we got like good reviews and in France and from people. Like, we weren't easily understandable in the States within the cultural context of music at that time.
Well, because you guys didn't sound like anyone else.
We sounded small.
Right.
But our small was because...
When you say small, it wasn't big, bombastic, arena rock kind of?
Yeah, it wasn't wide load American muscle rock.
Because what year was that? What year
was... It was like 92 or...
So that was
three.
The height of grunge,
yeah.
Essentially.
Which is, for me, it was just Rush in different clothing. Like, at that time, I didn't hate Rush. I didn't hate grunge. But I felt like I wanted to hear something that wasn't so fucking big.
Appeal to your aesthetic.
Yeah, because it just seemed like the oral equivalent of deforestation. It wasn't subversive. It wasn't rebellious to have big sounds that, like, are unrelenting in the United States of America. That's just, like, actually status quo. So that's the way I felt. And that it was a sort of an angry position. Like, it was, so we play and people are like, oh, these guys aren't loud enough. And I was just like, yeah.
That's the way I want it.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So fuck all y'all. So I was, yeah. So
but it's that choice that you're sticking with your gut, which is, I respect that a lot, that you, by making a hard right like that, you, by not trying to sound like everyone else, that's what made you guys successful.
Yeah. It was a little terrifying to do that. But it was also made us like Europeans were able to stomach our music when they really didn't. They weren't going for a lot of big, dumb American
you
rock.
You need to straighten your posture and suck in your gut. You need to pull back your shoulders and tighten your butt. Yeah, come Comanche, 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 come-o. If you want to have cities, you've got...
So you release this EP and it starts to get some movement more overseas.
Yeah, yeah. And then we released the whole album and, again, like, got distribution overseas.
And again, you self-released the album too?
Yeah, the self-released album.
Okay.
And then, like had some college radio play. And then we got an offer to re-release the album on a sort of indie label, but with that had distribution, called Capricorn Records, which was like basically a Southern rock label. Mm-hmm. It occurred to me that maybe this makes sense. And,
that's, Phil, what's his name?
Phil Walden.
Phil Walden. Yeah.
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 So who had, you know, interesting history there.
Totally.
It seemed like they kind of got us. Some of the people there kind of got us. In some ways they did not get us, but things went okay, and we released our second album with them, and they just happened to get distribution for that album, and things went pretty well. I think a lot of it because like for some reason we had distribution and promotion in a way that we haven't, I think, since then, like mm-hmm. ever. We've released albums. Strangely, I mean, maybe it's preserved us. Like maybe it's we haven't gotten too big. But a lot of times we'll release an album and then like months into like the album, like everybody's getting fired at the label and the label's closing down. It's literally been, that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like we've released some albums since then and, you know, done pretty okay, really, I think.
So Capricorn got a hold of you guys kind of, I mean, obviously you guys were sort of buzzed about, I hate that word, but you know, buzzed about in the sense that they saw that you guys were getting some movement on the seismograph, that the needle was moving a little bit, and they heard your demo, obviously. They heard something there.
Yeah, they heard actually the entire first album.
Okay.
Yeah, and said, well, we would like to release that. And they wanted to just buy it from us. And I said, no, you can license it. And they said, no, I only want to buy it. And I said, okay, well. And so finally we said, okay. Finally they said, okay, we'll license it. And so thankfully we still own that one album.
Did you guys just hit the road right away and toured in support of it?
It was horrible. It was relentless. And we were in a van that would catch on fire all the time. And, you know, I think that one year we went across the United States in a van three times, you know, and mm-hmm. I think we're on the road, like almost the entire year.
And then but you're building up a fan base.
Oh yeah. So. Yeah. It was amazing. I mean, people are hearing about us and for the first time and sort of, I think, getting us,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't think would ever happen. I mean, I thought it would be very slow, and it happened quicker than I thought.
Mm-hmm. How soon did you start recording Fashion Nugget after that? That was the next record, right?
Yes, as soon as we could get off the road, as soon as it was like, you know, okay, we're done promoting this album for the second time.
Right.
Because we felt like we already had done it. So, yeah, so we went out, we got off the road for a while, and we had the songs ready, and recorded it and then I, you know, that album blew up pretty much. And then it was really horrific for touring because it was just like this industry. It's so unusual for anybody to have success that this industry wants to just use every like ounce of any success. They just want to like take it all as far as it'll mm-hmm. go because it'll never happen again. And so a lot of people that I know who are heroin addicts and chain smokers and alcoholics, you know, I really don't judge them if they've been on the road for this industry. It's really eats people out.
Yeah. Chews you up and spits you out.
Yeah, it's not healthy.
Chicken McNuggets, shut the fuck up. No, shut the fuck up.
When you were recording the second record, did you have an idea that it was going to be as huge as it ended up becoming? Because is that still your biggest record? Is that still the...
I think it is. Our biggest song was from the next album. But I think our biggest album was from...
Was the second album, yeah. Did you have an inkling that it was going to just blow up?
I did. Yeah, I did. Yeah. I had a feeling. Before we released it, I had a feeling that I needed to, take a few weeks off and just, take a deep breath.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I had a feeling.
Well, you were right. Your intuition was right, I guess.
Yeah. So...
Back on the road right away.
Yeah. Back in a slightly bigger van. Like, we were in a cargo van instead of a VW van.
Right.
But it was still, just a lot of... I mean, just driving all night kind of stuff. Taking turns driving all night because there's no hotels that have any rooms.
That probably changed over the course of that tour, right? So once the record started doing really well,
Eventually we got a bus.
Moving on up.
Yeah, but it's actually it was a bus that, when it would stop at the truck stops to refuel, somehow it would suck up all the diesel smoke and fumes into the into your bunk cabin.
Ugh.
So you literally be suffocating on exhaust. And I just thought, wow, I guess this is the way it is. And I complained and eventually we got another bus and it was like, oh God, thank you. They're not all like that, but we had to pay our dues in terms of the bus situation as well. The bus thing is actually seems maybe glamorous from a distance, but it's absolutely frightening when you think about how little the drivers are vetted and how many of them are fully loaded on speed at 5 a.m. and they have your lives in their hands. And so we've had some near death experiences. The reason it seems glamorous is that they don't understand that that you get to town at about 4 or 5 in the afternoon after driving for maybe 16 hours.
Yeah.
The bus dumps you out. You maybe need to take a shower or something, but maybe there's no time. Sound checks at 5:30. You do your sound check. 6:30, you can have a choice. You can eat dinner,
which is usually shit.
Yeah, or you can take a nap, or you can go walk around and see the city. But you don't have Yeah, yeah. You don't have more than an hour or two before the show, and mostly you just are gonna be pacing and nervous because you're about to go on stage.
Yeah, you can't. There's no nap at 6:30. The adrenaline's already kicked in by that point. You know?
Right. So you go on stage and. And then you're off stage maybe 10:30, 11. And sometimes you get to stay at a hotel, or sometimes it's back into the bus for another 16 hours or so. And then you repeat that sometimes 9 days in a row. And then you'll have one day off. And usually your day off is in the middle of nowhere, somewhere in Texas, by the side of the freeway with a Waffle House across the street and a Walmart.
By this point, have you sort of embraced the surreality of it? Hey, 2 years ago I was playing in coffee shops, and now we're playing in theaters. Has that already hit you, kind of? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's kind of hit me, that things are messed up now. The weirdest thing for me was just to have people that were assholes to me suddenly super nice. That was actually one of the most disturbing things, is having people that had been previously rude to me now really sort of unctuous and friendly. That's really alienating.
Mm-hmm.
I wish people kept on being assholes.
Yeah.
So
suddenly everyone's your best friend.
Women too, who wouldn't even look at me. Fame for me wasn't very satisfying. It wasn't... Yeah. anything that I just like. I think I got into it to not be anonymous,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't get into it to be famous.
Right.
I got into it because I realized that I could do something that mm-hmm. maybe not everybody could do. And and if you find something that you do and like 4 hours go by and you think it's only a half an hour, that's probably what you should do with your life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I think pretty young I realized, wow, I can do this.
Yeah.
And then I started getting closer to like the dream of it and the sort of the what is deemed the exciting part of it. And I saw through it and wasn't thrilled.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish I could have been a little bit more thrilled. Some things happened after all the touring of the second record. There was sort of a coup within the band where the bass player quit the band and tried to get other people to quit. Nobody else would quit initially. I don't know. It's a long story, but we still are not on great terms. But anyway, so the band kind of fell apart. The lineup fell apart after that. But when he left, we ended up getting the bass player that was our bass player before him, who I sort of liked better anyway. And so there was a sort of reconfiguring of the lineup put out in that sort of uncertain, unstable sort of situation, I was able to put together a group of songs that I thought worked with different players. And so, we kind of made it work. And that third album was, called Prolonging the Magic. And that was, that had our biggest song, which was, Never There. And it was a song that did really well in like weird places like Brazil and parts of the world that I had never thought would really necessarily anything would work out.
I need your understanding, I need your love so much. You tell me that you love me so, you tell me that you care, but when I need you, baby,
you're never there.
That song actually would have been taken to pop radio had everyone not been fired. Like basically like the whole label was being gutted as our album was coming out. And
great timing.
The song was doing so well, an alternative that they wanted to take it over to pop, which would have been like a huge thing. Like it would have been like good money for us, but it would have made the album sell a lot. But it also might have like created backlash. So in some ways, who knows? Like maybe it's good that we didn't have a pop song played 24 times a day on mm-hmm. next to other songs that we hate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know. It's I think we're fine. But I got to make a video for that song. I thought I would make a country western style video of a guy driving a truck. And I got to ride in a helicopter for some of the shots of the truck driving down the highway. It was a good experience. And so the craft of it was a lot of fun at that point. The business stuff was just ridiculous, and it made me hate corporate America quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
To have like you put all of your work into something, and the deal is that they've got to fulfill their end of things. That's the arrangement, and then they sort of blow it.
It's
it was frustrating.
kind of the same album cycle, promotion, relentless touring.
Yeah, a lot of touring, similar kind of, you know, similar kind of just being tired of traveling all the time.
And then you came back and did Comfort Eagle.
Yes. Yeah, that was in early 2000s, I think 2001 maybe. And it was actually right before 9/11. So that album was in a way, it was just kind of getting going, and then 9/11 happened. And, you know, this, I think the first single was doing pretty well, which was Short Skirt Long Jacket. And then 9/11 happened, and suddenly everybody wanted to listen to, like, really, like, earnest and, like, sort of, you know, music, like, that had, you know, humor wasn't acceptable for a while in music. So it was a lot of Creed and you know, like, just really earnest, veins bulging from neck kind of music. So anyway, so then after that album, we found a way. Did we have another album after that?
Pressure Chief.
Yeah, Pressure Chief. And that was, what year was that?
That 04.
04. Yeah, so Pressure Chief, like, came out and he did, I don't think, like, commercially, I don't think it did as well as the record company would have liked. And then after that, we were able to extricate ourselves from the record deal that we were on. And you know, again, we're touring, we're doing the same thing this whole time. And
were you still in the Bay Area at this point?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I was in either Sacramento or the Bay Area.
Okay.
I was kind of back and forth. And, but we were at that point, we were trying to figure out whether we could release an album on our own label, because also what's happening is the music industry is being sort of decimated by the tech industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and the music industry is not adapting very well. It's not doing anything right. It's actually being bought out by the tech industry. Like, people in the music industry were receiving equity share of, like, companies that were negotiating with artists for, you know, for their music. So it was a really messed up moment. So we didn't know what to do, like, but we knew that we didn't want to be on a big label, you know, as the ship sinks. We wanted to be more flexible and not stuck, and so we decided to try releasing the next couple albums on our own label, and ended up doing quite well that way, and had our first number one record, you know, for an independent release. I just didn't think that would happen. It was also during a period of decline, so it was, I think, also set a record for the lowest
amount of sold sales
for a number one record.
Yeah, but
then somebody broke our record after that. Mm-hmm. So it's the whole thing is tanking. It was an honor to be
sure.
Like, but it was good that many people remembered who we were. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, because at that point you were almost 20 years
right.
deep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I think it's fine, you know, you know, so that's kind of where we are. We had our first number one, and then it's been a few years now, and I'm writing more songs and feeling like I'm going to release maybe one more.
You think you got one more left in the tank?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I'm getting grumpy, but I think I could do one more.
Okay. What made you want to move up to Portland?
Watching everybody I know that is not a stockbroker or doctor or pharma exec or startup guy leave the Bay Area. You know, in other words, like, you know, filmmakers, all the people that are doing stuff that's like, you know, that requires rent to be not so expensive left. And, you know, also I just think a place becomes less interesting when you don't have any musicians or filmmakers or alcoholics or degenerates. You know, I don't want to live in a community that doesn't have weirdo comic book collector guys.
Oh, then you're in the right place.
Yeah.
Mm. Let's jump into some records. Let's talk about some records that meant stuff to you.
Sure. This is Fela Kuti and Africa 70, the song Zombie, which is the first Fela Kuti song I ever heard, and it blew my mind. You know, there's a reason why Fela Kuti towers above much else.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, no go go unless you tell him to go.
Zombie.
Zombie, no go stop unless you tell him to stop.
Zombie.
Zombie, no go turn unless you tell him to turn.
Zombie.
Zombie, no go think unless you tell him to think.
Zombie.
This is a song from the Louvin Brothers, L-O-U-V-I-N Brothers. I was honored to have Charlie Louvin on one of our Unlimited Sunshine tours in the early 2000s, and got to know him pretty well. But this is the first Louvin Brothers song I ever heard, and it also just blew my mind and punched me in the stomach at the same time. And the song is The Great Atomic Power. And there's, if you like this song, there's so many other good Louvin Brothers songs.
Are you ready
for the great atomic power? Will you rise and meet your savior in the air?
So this is not the first song by James Brown I heard, but I heard it, you know, after I thought I heard everything, I heard this one, and I'm like, oh, wow, this is James Brown, Get on the Good Foot, parts one and two. You know, if you like Cold Sweat or Superbad, this is just as good.
Get past the people, get past the hitman.
This is an Argentinian composer, Astor Piazzolla. He's a strident communist, socialist, chain smoker. This is a song of his called Tango Tango. This is from a band called YMO, Yellow Magic Orchestra. This is a song from the album Technodelic. And I think this is my favorite piece from this song, from this album, called Pure Jam. Pure Jam by YMO. Thank you. This is a Brazilian songwriter that I got to know in the last 10 years or so by the name of Tom Zé, T-O-M, last name Z-E. And Tom Zé is a really, really smart, weird songwriter from Brazil, you know, really important from the 60s and 70s, from Tropicalismo and Os Mutantes stuff. And this song is called Ma. And I first heard this song and I just said to myself, holy shit. Tom Zé makes his own instruments out of like broken televisions and is just does whatever that fuck he wants to do. So this is an artist that used to be part of the Dave and Deke combo, and we did a lot of shows with them when we were coming up and playing shows on the West Coast, and then he just kind of went off on his own. His name is Deke Dickerson, and this is from an album, King of the Whole Wide World, and the song is called Double Clutchin', and yeah, we just think he's a great guitar player and singer and entertainer, and he wears good cowboy hats. This next song is my favorite. It's my favorite early Jonathan Richman song, and he told me that it was a song that he used to play to piss off hippies. But I think there's more to it, and this is the first Jonathan Richman song that just blew my mind. It's called "I'm Straight." And I loved the assertion of straightness, the assertion of ungrooviness. I think that's actually very subversive.
Say how I wanna take his place. So this phone call today concerns Hippie Johnny. He's always stoned. He's never straight. I saw you today, you know, walk by with Hippie Johnny. Look, I had to call up and say I wanna take his place. See, he's stoned.
This is an old Hippie Woody Johnny. Guthrie song. I was plagued by Woody Guthrie growing up, and rebelled against it, and then as an adult revisited and realized that it was really genius. And here's a Woody Guthrie song from a Folkways recording called More Pretty Girls Than One. And it's not about politics, or is it? I'm not sure.
Gals and one, more pretty gals and one. Every town I ramble around, more pretty gals and one. Look down that railroad line, that train rolled by. Train rolls by with a woman I love, and I hung my head and cried.
This next song is from an Almodovar soundtrack for the movie The Flower of My Secret. But Almodovar soundtracks are just generally pretty good, and especially if you like Spanish music, which I do. And and I think what I would like to play is En el último trago, which is an interpretation by Chavela Vargas. And Chavela Vargas has this great sort of raspy voice, and the guitar arrangement or the piano arrangement is beautiful, and so I hope you enjoy it.
Quiero ver a qué sabe tu olvido sin poner en mis ojos tus manos. Esta noche no voy a rogarte. Esta noche te vas de veras. Qué difícil tratar de olvidarte sin que sienta que ya no me quiera.
This next song is a Roy Orbison song. I think it's my favorite one by him. It's Over.
Your baby doesn't love you anymore. Golden days before they end, whisper secrets to the wind. Your baby won't be near you anymore. Tender nights before they fly.
There were a lot of amazing female vocalists that sang with James Brown and the JBs, and there's a really great collection called James Brown's Original Funky Divas, and it has Lynn Collins, Vicki Anderson,
Marva Whitney,
Yvonne Fair, Anna King. These women didn't get as much attention as they deserved, but they really kicked butt with that band. And the only problem is deciding which song to play. And I think the one that I feel like listening to right now is Lynn Collins. And I think I just want to hear her sing Rock Me again and again and again and again and again and again. So let's just rock this again and again.
Everybody get funky.
Now, huh?
Yeah, so Cake will be playing some shows this summer. We have a website, cakemusic.com. We're active on Facebook, making people angry about politics on Facebook. But also sometimes we announce our shows. We're playing a show in Bend, that I think still has a few tickets left.
And you guys are playing at Edgefield, I saw.
And we're playing at Edgefield, which I think is sold out.
Okay, that's with Ben Folds?
Yeah, with Ben Folds. Cool. But we just added a show in Bend, which has room left. And I think we're going to play a show with Ben in Boise, Idaho, and a bunch of shows in September. And check us out. Come hear us play music.
And is it Facebook/Cake Music as well?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And let's see. Oh, we're gonna do Fuji Rocks in August or late July, actually. There's a bunch of other shows. So check it out if you like to hear live music by us.
Awesome. Well, John, thanks so much for coming, man. I know you're super busy, but it's been a real treat to get to talk to you about the history of the band and hear some of your influences, and I really appreciate you coming by today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.